Good evening. K2RW, a little bit late. At this time, we begin the TechNet. TechNet number 1197 of the series that began way back in September of 1982. Mel, K2KEY, and Dick, K2RIW. With a little help of their friends, they're going to try to answer some of your questions about this hobby of ham radio and how to make it work better, how to understand all this stuff. And there's no end to wireless technology. You're going to see more and more things coming along. I've even forgotten the name of the darn new thing that just came along after Bluetooth and Zigbee. There's something else called Oxygen or something like that. There's another new system coming along. More and more of them. So the public has discovered that the things that work by radio are real fun and just can't get enough of it. Just walk down any street in New York City any day and you watch all those people talking to seemingly the nobody. They're talking into some kind of a radio that's connected to them. People just love to walk and talk, and they're willing to pay for it. Wish I had some of that money of what the cell phone companies are collecting. And that walking and talking and cell phones, you could say was a ham radio product of roughly 1970. Ham radio operators in roughly 1972 time frame were building small, portable, handy talkie radios, some of them with touch-tone pads on them. And you could say that was the beginning of a cell phone. At least there are some people who believe that. My good friend Reed Fisher, W2CQH, Whiskey 2, Charlie Queen Hotel, was working for Bell Laboratories at the time, working on the engineering of that system. And that was way back in roughly 1971, as I remember. Okay, a person signs into the TechNet to talk to Mel and Dick and their friends by giving us your call letters, your name, and the confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, WS2N, Paul, and yes, meaning he does have a question or a comment. So give us your check-in names and yeses and call letters at this time, K2RIW.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. John, with an ISS visible pass prediction for tonight.
Sounds good, John. Anyone else?
Yes.
I guess that was W2RYY. I recognized the voice even though I didn't hear the beginning. Was I correct on that one, Joe?
W2RYY, Joe, yes. Yeah. You know, when I'm coming up the internet, people on the repeater have priority over me, so it's very easy to cut me out.
Very fine. We've got to leave enough space in between the contacts for Joe to get his edge in word-wise. Okay, we've got John and Joe. Who else would like to check in? Give me your call letters, name, and that yes or no at this time.
WS2N, Paul, with a yes for the space report.
Nope.
2TTT, no.
Gordon.
W2CRP, no.
And QEO, no. Just, listening.
KC2MDT, Steve, no question.
KC2MIQ,
yes, Charlie.
Okay, so far the yeses are John, Joe, and Charlie. We also have some no's from Gordon, but Gordon, who runs a very significant tech net in New Jersey, Bergen Amateur Radio Club, I bet you we'll talk him into a question. You wait and see. W2TRP signed in as an anonymous person, but I'm pretty sure he had a no. Steve with a no. Did I miss anyone? And Paul has a question, quite possibly, and a space report. Did I miss anyone? N2RSO Frank. Frank, lucky for you, I'm wearing earphones. Your audio is 30 decibels lower than it should be. I may be the only person who heard you. You got a good signal, Frank, but no audio. Anyone else?
K2YO, Bernie, no.
Bernie with an also very nice signal, but a little bit low on the audio. Anyone else? Okay, and is Mel there? K2KEY. Mel, have you checked in? Didn't hear Mel yet, or at least didn't hear his audio. The first person who had a question, I believe, was John. Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. He had a question, comment, whatever, an ISS pass. Go right ahead, John.
Hey, good evening, Dick, everybody on the net. This is Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. John? Yeah, just thought I'd give you some little heads up here about an International Space Station visible pass this evening. It's going to take place just around 9 o'clock tonight. So if you got clear skies, you might want to take a look out the window or take a little stroll outside towards the, let's see, starting around 9 o'clock, the ISS will be on the horizon in the southwestern sky. By about 4 minutes after 9, it will be just slightly south of east at an elevation of about 65 degrees. And at about 8 minutes past 9, it will be at an azimuth of 55 degrees and going over the horizon at that point. The International Space Station will be in sunlight for the entire pass, although it won't be perfectly dark. It doesn't have to be perfectly dark. The ISS is very bright. So if you go outside and look basically from around the southwest to the east and then to the northeast from about 9 to about 8 or 9 minutes after 9 tonight, you'll see a bright star moving in the sky. That's the International Space Station, and you'll be seeing the sunlight reflected off the spacecraft. K2RIW on the TechNet from KD2BD.
Very fine, John. Thank you for that report. Some of the members of the Astronomical Society of Long Island, ASLI, have on occasion dialed into the right website, found out when an illuminated pass of the International Space Station is going to take place. Some of them have actually done photography of the events. If you use a real high-gain telescope set in just the right position at the right time, it dips through your telescope screen real fast. But if you do that, there are people who have captured some very nice pictures. There was a man in England 6 months or a year ago that did that. And if the sun glints off of the solar arrays, which are now getting larger and larger in area as time goes on, probably Paul, WS2N, will bring us up to speed on that. Those solar cells, when they flash at you just right, is considerably brighter than a star and a planet. There are times when I think you get a magnitude minus 4, minus 10, something really bright when the space station is just in the right orientation. So that can be kind of a fun thing to look for between 9:04 and I guess around 9:08 tonight. What is the website that you go to, John, by which you find out this information? You might want to cast that URL to the group. Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I get Keplerian orbital data from, I believe it's spacetrack.org, and I run that through a piece of software that I wrote that predicts the passes and tracks the satellites in real time. So, yeah, there are websites like heavensabove.com that do these things, but I've got software here that does it for me. Yeah, I've seen some of those photographs of people who will photograph transits of the ISS across the sun or across the moon, and I imagine you have to be in just the right position in order, we have to be able to be mobile and get to the right position so that actually happens where you're taking your photography. But it's an interesting silhouette. You get to see the solar panels, and there have been some people who are doing the nighttime passes, as you mentioned, and photographing them and making out the different modules that are on the ISS. I guess the hard part is keeping the telescope on the object because it's moving at about, I think, how many seconds of arc per second, but it's pretty quick. As far as velocity right now, it's moving at 17,207 miles an hour. So it zips along pretty quickly. It's at an altitude of 221 nautical miles right now. K2RAW on the TechNet from KD2BD.
Very fine, John. A smart person with a little bit of geometry could figure out a 221 nautical mile altitude. If it passes close to straight overhead, or even if you know it's at a 60-degree angle, and it's moving a little bit less than 17,500, I think it's at 17,000, roughly 200 miles an hour, you could easily calculate the angular rate. And not only can you take a picture of the International Space Station when it's against the moon or against the sun, which gives you a silhouette, but the more fun picture that I've seen is where it's against blue sky, so to speak, at high noon, or at a reasonable daylight hour, and you get a real photograph of the space station itself. The way people have done it, because it zips through your eyepiece of your telescope, when you've got enough gain on the telescope to make something that far away, it's probably going to be on average 250 nautical miles from you at a slant angle. To take even something as big as a space station, I don't know its exact dimensions, but if I had to make a guess, I would say it's a healthy 200 feet long. Paul's going to bring us up to speed on that. But you take a 200-foot long object from 250 miles away, you probably want a gain of 300 on the telescope, which means it's going to zip through your eyepiece in a very small fraction of a second. So what people have done is, with a very good tracking program, calculate exactly what angle it's going to be from your particular spot on the Earth. In other words, you know the Keplerian elements, you've got a good computer program, you know the latitude and longitude where you're standing. You aim at that point in the sky, you calculate exactly what universal time is going to come zipping through your eyepiece, and a few seconds before that time, you start your charge-coupled device camera that's connected to the eyepiece in the movie mode, where you're taking X number of frames per second, and with a little bit of luck, one or two of those frames will include the International Space Station zipping through your eyepiece. I've seen a couple of those pictures, very well done. So you do it by spacetrack.org, I think you said. I like the heavensabove.com one better, because you go to heavensabove.com and you plug in your city or Latin long, however you know where your place is on the Earth. Just knowing that you're X number of miles away from New York City would be good enough. And it'll tell you when the next passes are that are going to be very desirable, because they're in sunlight when you're in the shadow, so to speak, and therefore you're going to be looking at this very bright object you get in the sky. Now, of the people who signed in, I suddenly realized that W2TRP is my good buddy Irwin, who I should have recognized him right away. Irwin, let me pass it over to you for a couple of words. I've used your previous experience on a couple of occasions of where I believe you had a contract with Brookhaven Laboratory.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And that's proof that I'm getting long-winded. Irwin, I believe you had a contract with Brookhaven Laboratory to inspect a certain number of the oil burners on Long Island, and I believe your discovery was that a significant number of them were set too rich. In other words, too high an oil-to-air ratio to give an efficient burn without making a lot of soot. Did I remember that correctly? And I'm guessing that was about 20 years ago that you did that. And to your knowledge, I hope you're on frequency, give me a couple of words on this, that did anything come from that survey? I hope that some improvement took place. I do my own oil burner service. I'm rather horrified by the stories that I hear of people who I think are missetting burners. W2TRP for a few words, if you're there, Irwin. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, K2RIW and the net. I'm having problems with my teeth. I have a denture until they fix it with the implant. Hi. Yes, no, that's right. And I'm starting the research again. I'm going to be going around some homes. And my articles appeared starting in 1975. I was on the front page in 1980, and the person that did my articles, Ed Lowe, I understand, I was trying to get a hold of him, and I found out that he had a stroke. But maybe we have to start the energy net again, because heating oil is going to be $5 a gallon at least. W2RIW and the net, W2TRP.
Very good information, Irwin. Awful glad I recognized your call letters and went back to you. So that was 1975. Yes, Ed Lowe had a whole series of human interest articles in Newsday, which I greatly enjoyed. For reasons I don't understand, Ed Lowe was dismissed from Newsday and went to another newspaper. and sometime after that did have a stroke. I, for one, definitely enjoyed his human interest stories that were there. What I'm discovering, and maybe you discovered something similar, not only are we worried about the carbon loading of the atmosphere, not only are we worried about the efficiency of our oil burners, not only are we worried about the price of petroleum going through the ceiling, and for the most part it's going to continue to rise. We're going to have some momentary ups and downs, but the whole darn world is discovering that oil is a great stuff. You've got billions of people in India and China and places like that that want to start living like Americans, so they're going to be demanding the oil to run their vehicles that they're about to purchase. So the situation is going to get worse. We got to do something to become energy independent. But along those lines, it behooves us to make sure that our oil burner is running correctly. I, for one, have taken the nozzle that was in my hot water heater and the nozzle that was in my furnace and cut them back considerably in size. I think my nozzle started off at something like 1 gallon per hour on my particular furnace for the house, and I think I've got it down to like 6/10 of a gallon per hour. My motivation for doing that is so that I can easily get a higher air-to-oil ratio, get a cleaner burn. The slight disadvantage of that scheme is that my oil burner runs a little bit longer, and the heating of the house is a little bit slower. And if I had a super cold day at minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit with a high wind, maybe my house would only get to 65 degrees Fahrenheit that particular day, and I'd wear a coat. I'm willing to do that. And in order to have an oil burner that is quiet, a number of the homes I visited, people have nozzles that are much too big, running much too low a air-to-oil ratio, and the oil burner continuously rumbles. And I say to the people, how in the world do you tolerate that soot, that smell, and that rumbling sound from an improper burn? And I told them, please talk to your oil burner service person, and try to talk him into putting a smaller nozzle in there with a better fuel oil to air ratio. And each of those people I've talked to their service person, who looked at them real funny and said, no, I'm not going to change it. This is the way it was designed. It's supposed to run that way. We've always done it this way. On top of that, let me drop. When they adjust for the best, what they think is fuel to air ratio, which they think is the best temperature of burn, which I strongly disagree with, I'm willing to use a little bit more air so that the burn temperature is a little bit lower, but I'm getting a cleaner burn. My oil burner, if you look on the inside, the soot is tan colored, not black. Black soot tells me you've got incomplete burning. You've either got a nozzle that's not getting a fine enough mist because it hasn't been changed often enough, or you've got a poor fuel air to fuel ratio. So I'm using small nozzles, lots of air. I back off a little bit on the temperature, but get a cleaner burn. I get a very tan-colored soot in the furnace, and the rate at which the soot builds up in the tubing and the furnace and the exhaust pipe, I have to clean it once every 3 or 4 years, whether it needs it or not. I'm only half-choking when I say that. There are people who have got such a dirty burn in their furnace that cleaning it once per year is not enough. That's craziness. How do we tolerate that? You can see I've got strong emotion on this one because oil's getting expensive, we're wasting it, and people are putting up with smell, high price, wasted oil, and a large rumbling sound. Other than that, they're happy. But that's a very left-handed piece of humor. Over to you, for Erwin, if you want to make any comments on all of the above. I'm hot under the collar under this one. There's a pun there somewhere. W2GRP, K2RAW in the tech net.
K2RIW and the Technic, W2TRP. No, that sounds good. The only thing that I would recommend that I've done is up the pump pressure from 100 PSI, I believe I went up to about 115 PSI. That cuts down the particle size, and I found I'm burning more efficiently, things like that. And I'm using a 0.7 nozzle right now with a higher pump. With a higher pump pressure, and I should send some of my articles into the log and all that. They're hanging on my wall, and I'm getting hot under the collar again to get slaughtered with this. I'm in touch now with Bacharach, trying to get some more later test equipment than what I have, And also another thing is, if your house, if you have three levels in your house, I'd recommend making the upper level on its own zone. I had one zone in my split level house, and Honeywell read my articles, and they sent me three motor driven valves, the transformer, and all the wiring, three setback thermostats, and I did the plumbing, and that cut down quite a bit, because in the daytime, a lot of people do not have a thermostat in the bedroom, and they are heating the living room, and you just you can't even things out. So you really want to have a thermostat on each floor, and also all the hot water pipes in the basement, every one of them. You buy this foam pipe insulation, which is split. That's another thing. And then at one time I was running the hot water up in the attic in the summertime to preheat it and all that, but I found that was quite a job. But I'm getting hot under that again. And also, I'm also thinking on getting back into fast scan television. And you probably remember that one, Dick. W2RIW and the net, W2TRP.
Question,
W2. L2.
Okay, I heard LTY, but TTP, TTT, I think, was first. Gordon, with your question, go right ahead.
Okay. As an aside, as a preface, if you're going to get interested in doing fast tests, you might suggest it, or have a digital MPEG, or streaming, through my IP stream, that would be the best way to go. But that's just me. Number two, I have a two-zone system and a four-level house. I have an old Dutch colonial that's got a 95% efficient gas electric heater air conditioner combination on the upper two layers of floors, and 90% efficient one of the basement drives the lower two floors, like you said. And I was just wondering, I use gas, natural gas, and electricity. So what would you recommend, and it's forced air, by the way. So what would you recommend for optimizations that I could possibly entertain?
Okay, Gordon did say he's running natural gas to heat his house, and he's asking for optimizations. However, I just heard a National Public Radio report, I think it was on Friday, stating that there's a huge misconception going on when it comes to natural gas versus oil. There are people who think natural gas is a much greener fuel than oil. First of all, I think oil is a little bit cheaper in BTUs per dollar, you know what I mean? However, the methane that's released in the process of obtaining, processing, using natural gas apparently is a very non-green material that's being dumped into the atmosphere. If that NPR report is accurate that I heard, there's a huge area there that hasn't been properly installed, properly investigated about natural gas and what it's doing to greenhouse gases and global warming and carbon loading and so on. So there's a lot more to the story than first meets the eye. I got a quick question for you, and I know there's another person with a question, but still, you said you've upped the pressure of your pump, and I couldn't hear whether you were saying 115 or 150 pounds per square inch. The pump usually runs 100 pounds per square inch, and you've upped the pressure. I think there's a control knob. You've got a screwdriver-adjusted thing, I believe, which adjusts the pressure on most pumps. On the Sunstrand, I think is the brand name of a pump. It's a gear pump. And did you up it to 115 or 150? Second of all, a lot of people don't know it, but you've got to change the nozzle every year, if not sooner, because no matter how hot finely you filter the oil, and I've got two cascaded filters, by the way, and boy, what a change that makes. I've got both a coarse oil filter and a fine oil filter in that order that the oil flows through before it gets to my burner. And if I didn't do that, the fine one would be clogging all the time, and the coarse one is there to get rid of the really big junk so that the fine one doesn't clog. But that fine particles that get through are eroding that nozzle, and as such, it doesn't give you the proper spray. So if you've got a brand new nozzle of the right size, and I don't even think it's quite as important as to whether or not it's a cone type or a solid type, just that it's giving you a very fine atomization of the fuel, and I guess the higher pressure helps do that on a good fresh nozzle. So it was a 150 or 115, Erwin. W2TRP, kilowatt number 2, Romeo India Whiskey. You got it, Erwin.
K2RIW, W2TRP. Come on in, talking. Maybe a little noisy. I upped it to 115, 115 pounds. I've gone as high as 125 pounds, and I've had no problems, but you're right. You want to get a small particle filter, especially if you're going for for a very, very small nozzle. I'm having problems. I just got a bunch of implants, and I haven't loaded them yet, so I'm having a little trouble speaking. And maybe I can get some more information and bring it up on the next net and all that. And I haven't been down in meetings in years. Probably, I would say 10 years. I've been very active with a lot of the veterans group, being a vet myself. And I'm into songwriting now and stuff like that. Selma wants to get back on the air, and I think I'm going to get the low band, the FT-101C, fired up if it still works. K2RIW in the group, W2TRP.
Very fine, Erwin. Erwin, your speech sounds beautiful. I know you feel a little bit self-conscious that your new implanted teeth are not completely installed and working correctly. Your speech sounds beautiful to me, but don't worry about that. And please come back next week and give us any more information on the subject, because I look back at my past fuel oil bills, and I've got a 250-gallon tank, because I buy spot oil. I don't have a delivery service. I don't have a contract. How people tolerate either one of those, I don't know. And the only reason I can tolerate, of course, not having a contract is because if my oil furnace, oil-fired furnace, or hot water heater failed on Christmas morning at 2 a.m., I've got a bunch of spare parts. I've got the knowledge to fix it. It's not rocket science. I go repair it. I got a spare ignition transformer. I got spare nozzles and so on. I just bring it back on the air. It's simple. To be dependent on a service and to pay an extra $100-some-odd a year or $200 a year to do it and pay top price for the oil at the same time, again, I don't know how people tolerate that. But I look back at my past fuel bills. There were times when I would get on a 275-gallon tank, I would load 255 gallons in. In other words, I've only had a few gallons left when I told the guy to come and deliver. And what I've done on a couple of occasions, if I ran out because I cut it a little bit too close, I just go with my fuel can, which is the oil-type fuel can, the red one, is it, or a yellow one? The yellow one that you can buy in any aftermarket automobile store, and stand by. I simply go and buy a couple of gallons of diesel fuel at the nearest gas station that sells diesel fuel. It's the exact same stuff. And yes, you're paying a little bit of extra tax for it. Big deal. But it heats the house on a cold winter night if I cut it too close. But what I'm getting at here is that there are times when I filled my tank for $150, 200 and some odd gallons. Lately, the last time I filled my tank, 250 gallons, was $800-some-odd. Oil's getting expensive, as if you guys don't already know that. So making the burner run clean, efficient, quiet, not making a lot of soot. We amateurs who like tweaking things, this is an area which is a little bit off to one side. Yeah, it's the electronics that fires the ignition system and the oil. But considering the dollars that flow into that particular object in your house, and if you can make the dollars flow more efficiently. I mean, in the past, I used to heat my house, a three-bedroom ranch, for a whole season for numbers like $600. Well, that's going to change this year, I can tell. But I think I've burned as much as 450 or so gallons per year. And I know people who burn a couple of thousand gallons per year, and they don't have that much more area than I do. So I know a lot of inefficiency is taking place. But we amateurs are smart enough that if we can make this system efficient, and those dollars that you save can allow you to buy a new rig, and you can justify it with the XYL, you can see where I'm coming from here. There was another person after Gordon who signed in with a question, and I think it was RSO, but I'm not sure. You know who you are. Please go ahead with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2RIW, I think it's me now. I think I'm second question up. You may want to just check those to be correct on that.
You want the second questioner, Joe, when it comes to the general questions. I did a little branch off here with reference to oil, and after W2TT team signed in with a question, I thought there was another person. Let's stand by and see if there was another person.
Yeah, Dick, it's 32 LTY Bridge. I don't know if you were looking for me a few minutes ago.
Yes, that's LTY. I think it's Rich. Go right ahead with your question, if it was on the subject of oil. Go right ahead.
When I turned on the radio, I thought you mentioned my name, that you were looking for me to ask me a question about oil. That other gentleman who has his pressure at 115, he should turn it up to 150 and watch how it runs.
I have raised it up to like 130, 140. I really didn't have problems. But I did back it off. And also, I just want to make one other comment. I have an elapsed time meter on my oil burner, so I can tell exactly how many gallons I'm using, or very close how many gallons I'm using. And I want to make just one other comment, and that is that I started my article because the oil went from, I think it was 16 cents a gallon to 25 cents a gallon. That's when I started my article.
Boy, 10 days are gone forever. Wow. 16 to 25 cents a gallon. Yeah, I look back at my past bills, and not very many years ago, I was paying numbers like 50 some odd cents a gallon. Wow, what a difference is going on here. Mr. LTY, I think you have a lot of knowledge about oil burners, if you're the guy I think you are. And is there any disadvantage, you know, of going as high as 150 pounds per square inch on the oil pump that fires the nozzle as part of the so-called blast tube assembly? Is there a disadvantage of 150 pounds per square inch? Because I see a strong possibility of it giving a much finer atomization, therefore a more complete burn. Does it put anything else under stress? As long as you're changing the nozzles fast enough, and as long as you've got real good filtering. I think I've got good filtering. It was both a large coarse filter followed by a fine filter in that order. And I've also got one of the pressure gauges that I've installed in the fine filter by which I can now measure the back pressure of the vacuum, so that if my tube going back to the oil tank becomes partially clogged, I can sense it by the fact that a lot of vacuum is occurring. That tells me either the filter is partially clogged or the pipe is partially clogged. And I own one of these CO2 clean-out devices, very inexpensive, for cleaning out the oil line when it occasionally clogs, which does happen. I've got a 1957 house, which means, what, the 50-year-old house. So the oil tank has been sitting there for 50 years, and it's collected some sludge by now, and occasionally does get a clog. So, Rich, I think it is, LTY. Go right ahead with any information on all of the above. QRIW on the TechNet.
Well, running the burner at 150 PSI gives you a much finer spray from the nozzle. You just got to lower the firing rate with the nozzle. If you're burning at a gallon, you got to put like a .85, and it'll give you the same effect at that high pressure. As long as the pump goes, if it's capable of delivering 150 PSI, it should will not get damaged. Normally, the pumps, I believe, are rated between 100 and 200 PSI. So at that pressure, it's not going to damage anything. It gets more atomized, and you get a cleaner burn. So that's what I have. I have a real yellow burner. That's the way that it comes back at that high pressure. I was just wondering, the other gentleman, what kind of a burner he has on his boiler.
We'll find that out pretty fast, Rich. Alrighty. Now, I do not own a pressure gauge that can measure the 150 or whatever, 200 pounds per square inch. I presume I would unplug the nozzle, plug that pressure gauge in there temporarily, and run the pump. I presume that's the way it's done. And I presume also that there's a spring-loaded screwdriver set adjustment on the side of the pump, which adjusts the pressure. That's one thing that I've never fiddled with up till now, Rich. Give me a couple of words on that to make sure I'm not getting myself in trouble. This is LTY, K2RIW.
W2PNJ.
PNJ recognized, but Rich first.
Yeah, that's where you would put the pressure gauge, right on the nozzle line. You can get a pressure gauge. They're inexpensive. They're like $12. You just need a little adapter, and you're all set to go. Just disconnect the nozzle line, put your gauge on, turn the burner on, and you just turn that little screw like you mentioned. It's not spring-loaded as far as I know. I've never seen one yet. You just make the adjustment to 150, and you're all set. But like I say, you got to put a smaller nozzle in to compensate for the higher pressure. I have a few numbers written down somewhere for different firing rates to what size nozzle to use to get the same effect. Now, like I say, I know 100 a gallon per hour at 150 using a 0.85 will give you the same 1 gallon per hour BTU rate.
Bob recognized them. That's good to know. So if I had a 1 gallon per hour, 0.85 at 150 pounds will do the same thing. Reynolds number is the reason why they're not the linear. The higher pressure does not, doubling the pressure would not quite double the oil flow because the oil is going through a significant restriction. Take apart one of those nozzles and you'll see it's a beautiful piece of high pressure engineering, the way the oil gets swirled inside of the nozzle assembly so that it comes squirting out of that tiny little hole, spinning like the hammers of hell at a real high rate. I think it was Mr. PNJ. I think that's Bob in Kings Park. Go right ahead, Bob.
Good evening, everyone on the net. If it's a SunStrand pump or a Webster pump, you don't have to bother with the nozzle assembly. There's a pressure port, which has a plug in a threaded, I think it's 3/8, I'm not sure, it's 5/16 or 3/8, probably 3/8 plug. You could take that out and get yourself a, what I have on my pump, on my oil burner, is a, I bought a gauge, 0 to 200 PSI, but it's got to be an oil-filled gauge because the way that pump works, you're going to get too much of a swing, too much vibration on that mechanical pump to give yourself an accurate reading. But if you go with an oil-filled gauge, Granger sells them, the gauge is full of like a silicone fluid, you will get a steady-state reading. And there's another plug that you take out where there's, you go in with an Allen key while the pump is running, and you adjust it clockwise increase, counterclockwise decrease.
Beautiful information, Bob. I'm going to pass it back to you in a second to find out, do you believe Sid Harvey, who is where I buy most of my parts from for oil burner service? They've got a great place over there in Melville, Farmingdale area, right alongside of, I think it's called New Highway. Not on New Highway, but close to it. I can't think of the name of the street they're on. So Granger sells it, Sid Harvey sells it, and it's a gauge that has a kind of damping to it. Otherwise, the gauge would be dancing with the gear pump, I guess, is giving you pulses, so to speak. And I guess it's the spring mechanism downrange that smooths it out as far as what actually goes to the nozzle. Another very important device that a lot of people don't have, don't know about it, don't realize the huge difference it makes, is the cutoff valve. In the line that comes from the pump over to the blast tube assemblies and your nozzle, if you have an electronically operated time-delayed cutoff valve, the net result is that the oil burner turns on, the valve is in the closed mode, the oil burner builds up full RPM of its blower motor and its pressure, then a couple of seconds later the valve opens, squirts the oil into the nozzle, and you get a nice clean burn. At the end of the burn, the first thing that happens is the valve closes off. Then the oil burner slowly slows down. If you don't do that, you've got a squirrel cage blower that's slowing down. It's not providing air. You've got back pressure of oil in the system, in the pumping system, with its accumulator, which is now going to slowly drip oil through that nozzle under low pressure into a burning flame. And that is the ugliest burn you've ever seen in the world. I have, on a number of occasions, cleaned out my blast tube assembly. In other words, the air chunk, the air tube that goes down to the nozzle that supplies the oil, supplies the vaporized oil, and it therefore burns. I've noticed great big chunks of black soot around that years ago, and it was because the end of the burn, this dripping oil, is now improperly atomized, improperly aerated, and sitting there burning and making soot that eventually jams up the whole end of the blast tube assembly. A hell of a lot of people don't have that cutoff valve. I'm going to pass it around to each one of the oil experts we got on frequency here, which includes Irwin, Rich, and Bob in that order, to make some comments on that cutoff valve. I found that out by going to one of these. Let me drop. There was one of these displays at the Walt Whitman Shopping Center, right in the mall itself, talking about these high-efficiency retention burners and whatever, and they mentioned this cutoff valve. I said, gee, that's interesting. And I put it together with all of the cleaning I used to have to do. I had a clean burn when it comes to the flue pipes of my system, but I didn't get a clean burn right at the end of the nozzle. I would get the soot buildup, and I was wondering how in the world it was happening. It was the lack of the cutoff valve. I bet you saw a lot of furnaces without that cutoff valve in your investigation, Irwin. Looking forward to hearing from you next week also. W2TRP, if he wants to make a comment on this. K2LIW in the TechNet. I'm hearing Irwin on the input. I'll describe what he's saying to you guys later.
Is he in a better range of the machine that's out in Suffolk?
Negative, Nassau. Very fine, Irwin. Irwin, absolutely none of that came through the machine. I heard you beautifully on the input. I heard everything you said, but none of it came through the machine. I think you fell into a trap. You moved your handy-talkie around the room until it sounded the best on the output frequency of the machine. That happened to be one of the nulls for the input frequency on the machine, but none of that came through. Now, choose another location. On a quick break, and I'll repeat everything you said to the group. On a quick break, you have or have not seen in the early investigations you did back in the 70s of that so-called cutoff valve that goes to the nozzle. You did or did not see that on your investigations on many of those oil burners. Back to you, Irwin. Okay, Irwin did say that he did not see that nozzle. It was not a popular item in the 70s when he was doing his investigation that was funded by Brookhaven Laboratory. He also was saying that he's looking forward to getting back into amateur television. He's been away from ham radio for quite a while, but doing quite a few other things. But he's happy that these other two knowledgeable people about oil burners are telling us about all of the above. Looking forward to seeing you next week, Irwin. I hope you'll get a chance to use your rooftop antenna. Andy Jockey's from your... I think you live in Nassau, but I'm not sure of the town. Somebody suggested you should go through the 147-375 machine in Selden. I'm not sure that that would be better for you. I think you're closer to Glen Oaks. Alrighty, let's turn it over to, KC2LTY. Rich, do you have any comments on how many oil burners do you see with that cutoff valve? And have you seen that great big chunks of soot that takes place on the end of the burn if you don't have that cutoff valve? You got it, Rich.
Oh, yeah. I would probably guess there's about 98% of all the equipment out there do not have that delay valve. That makes a big difference. That's the second secret on keeping a boiler running nice and clean. You eliminate the soot on startup and shutdown. That's 99% of the boilers out there, run that way. The new equipment, the new Beckett's, they have the that type of valve built into the pump, just like the Riello's are. That's why you have the Riello burners. Next question is, I got, when did you install that delay valve on your unit?
Very unhappy to say I installed that delay valve a year and a half, 2 years ago, and I was doing my own service ever since 1970. And I found out about that very late. I found out about it 10 years ago, and then finally decided to get around to it because I bought a new center flue type hot water heater, which got a whole lot of fine fingers inside. That's the good news. And it's got very good heat exchanging when it's nice and new and clean. One day I saw quite a bit of soot coming out of my chimney when the hot water heater was running, and I did an investigation and found out that that center flue pipe was almost completely closed off. I was getting to the point where it was going to create such a back pressure that all the flue gases were probably going to be dumped into the house. I came very close to a dangerous condition. I got a CO2 detector, and I think it would have detected it, but even so, dangerous condition, because it had completely filled up because of the unclean burn at the start and stop because of the lack of that switch, and as I said, that center flue completely clogged, and I suddenly realized something drastic required. Put in that switch, the cutoff valve, and the delay cutoff valve, I guess it's called, which you can buy at Sid Harvey, among other places. It's about a $5 item. To not have it on your oil burner is crazy. Really crazy. There are lots and lots of people who are positive they don't like oil. They're switching over to gas because they think an oil burner is noisy. They think it smells poor. They think it makes a lot of soot. And they think it's just a dirty thing to have around. Any of those characteristics are because of improper setting, improper maintenance, improper operation, improper equipment. The oil burning process itself, I mean, petroleum is the highest energy density fuel you can get your hands on. That's why you're running your automobiles on it, a petroleum product. To have a petroleum product heating your home and heating your water and not to have it run efficiently is more than a crime. And the people who do the maintenance for you are the people who sell you the oil. And my goodness, is that a conflict of interest. If the oil burner is running inefficiently and you burn more oil, he sells you more oil and makes a profit, a bigger profit. And he's the guy selling you the oil. The answers I got from my friends that I told them to go to a smaller nozzle, to ask their service person to go to a smaller nozzle and set the fuel-air ratio better so they get rid of all of that rumble and soot. And the answers they got from their service people, as if they were saying, hey, you're telling me how to do my business, and I'm not going to listen to you. That was their attitude. I told them, boy, you've got the wrong person doing it. You may have some comments on this, Rich, before I go over to Bob. Rich first. KC2LTY. Thank goodness you guys are here. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2KEY.
Well recognized also. Well, Rich first, go ahead.
Yeah, I would say most of the oil companies out there are going to have that type of attitude. If they have a unit running clean, it's going to be very efficient. Now, if you have a boiler that will get suited up dirty in 6 months, the efficiency drops, the oil company is going to be selling more oil, and the homeowner's dollars go up out the chimney. The next big thing I noticed in working with oil is the boiler manufacturer will rate the boiler for a nozzle on a capacity. And 99% of the time, That nozzle they tell you to use is too big, because the flame will, if it hits the target wall or the side, either side of the chamber, the flame will get distorted and not burn clean anymore. You just want to have the flame fill the chamber, and it'll burn a lot better. You know, you're going to wind up with a smaller burn. It'll just run a little longer, like you said before. You're still going to get the heat. That's one thing I noticed, big thing. The next thing is, one of the most important tools on adjusting the flame is a device called a smoke tester. They're about $80-$90. You get that at Sid Harvey. A little device put into the stack, and it takes a sample of the flue gas. And if it's on a little piece of paper, you put in there, smoke paper. And if it comes up anything black or a little dirty, then you have a dirty flame. You just adjust it until you have what they call a zero smoke. That's what I use, man. Works great. I haven't cleaned my boilers in years, and they're clean as a whistle. Like the flue pipe is like yours, but the tan is color.
Give that man a cigar. Fantastic. I thought it was me. Each time I looked at the recommended size nozzle for my hot water heater and the recommended size nozzle for my furnace, and I came to the conclusion they were much too big, I thought it was me. I thought it was just my crazy attitude. But I discovered that on both of those devices, because of the restrictions on the total amount of air that can come out of the squirrel cage blower, I couldn't get the right fuel-air mixture that would please me. Either I had too much back pressure in the furnace itself, plus the flue pipes, which I don't think so. I think the flue pipes in my case, I think, are 8-inch diameter. I can't believe that a clean flue pipe like that was making back pressure. The system just couldn't supply enough air with the recommended size orifice for the burner, the nozzles, I'm trying to say. And in the case of the hot water heater, it's got a beautiful heat exchanger, a center flue heat exchanger with a whole bunch of fins in the side, these little fine fingers. But boy, does that make back pressure. Again, I couldn't get enough air in there to get a clean burn. You're recommending a smoke detector, a smoke sampling device. And I think that's good. And that's the right way to do it in a quantitative way. I open up the right trap door and look in there and look at the top of the flame. And if I see if I see the wrong color, it should be a nice, bright flame with no black tips to it, so to speak. Those black tips are soot that's coming out of complete combustion. What comes out of your nozzle, let me drop. If your nozzle was the most ideal thing in the world, it would have extremely fine particles and nothing but fine particles. That's the good news. And they would be completely combusted by sufficient air and a flame. In reality, your nozzle is going to make a Gaussian distribution of particles. Some of them are big and some of them are small. And so a perfect nozzle is going to have a very small distribution of that Gaussian distribution, you know, a very small range, and a real nozzle is going to have a significant range. Some of those particles are large particles. Unless you supply excess air, those large particles do not completely burn. They make soot. They make carbon monoxide. Not only are you getting a sooty flame, you're getting a dangerous flame, but there's the slightest amount of leak in that system into the house. We're talking about human safety. We're talking about dollars and cents. We're talking about efficiency. We're talking about greenhouse gases. We're talking about global warming. It's all tied together, and we're all dependent on that furnace, whether it be gas-fired or oil-fired, and to have it run inefficiently on billions of homes in the United States, and we're importing 20 million barrels of oil per day, and to burn it inefficiently, to me, is a crime. It's a correctable condition. It's not that high a technology. It's not rocket science. The guys within the sound of my voice have got enough knowledge about radio, and to join, good number of you guys have got enough knowledge about automobiles to have just a little bit more study, to buy the book from Sid Harvey that costs you a couple of dollars that'll explain every one of the components of your oil burner furnace that you're pouring thousands of dollars into per year to heat your home now that oil is so expensive. To not have knowledge about that and control about that, is something that's opposite of the ham radio philosophy. I know this is off subject, but again, it is something that is a life-threatening device if it's misset. And if it's set correctly, you can save enough dollars to buy more ham radio rigs. It's the quickest way you can save money I can think of, other than giving up cigarette smoking. The dollars per year that people put into that is an awful big waste. I'm going to turn it over to Bob, but before I do, I've got to turn it over to my co-owner of this net, Mel, K2KDY. I know you wanted to make a comment. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, so the Lingle Bank station going over at 901, guys.
Thank you for the International Space Station going over right now. Mel, you've got it.
Okay, well, I have not seen an oil truck in my area here in years. Most of the houses here, or I should say most of the more than half the block of houses here, like new houses, all have gas heat, gas hot water. Now, in the case of my house, this is the older house here, one of the older houses on the block, original house. Some years ago, what happened, my oil tank began to leak and they the oil dripping. And I called the oil company that I dealt with, dropped it. And they came and took a look at it. They said, well, your oil tank is shot. It's got to be replaced. And they gave me some price on that. When I spoke to our gas company here, they said, well, what we'll do is we'll replace the whole work. Take it out. Take out the oil burner, take out the tank, the whole work, and put you in a new gas burner for no charge, NC, no cost. And guaranteed they had a gadget on it that would measure the whatever heck consumption of something, whatever. Whatever they had, they did some measurements, and they guaranteed me that my bill for heating the house that year would average less than I did on oil. And believe it or not, Dick, it worked over.
Call, please. A person who said call, there's a net in process. Do you have an emergency? Go ahead.
Not. I want to say something about the program. It's Kansas over you.
Okay, you said it so fast, I didn't hear what you said. Slow it down, sir.
You know I'm fast all the time. Anyway, I know something about boilers. I used to rebuild them. I used to fix them. I'm not a mechanic. I used to be a helper. Boilers, some of them is 100 years old. Some of them is not. It's converted to be oil and gas. Look at it. It gets coal and run by the diesel. It gets steel and run by the gas. Back to you.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is quite a few of the boilers in some of the older houses were really set up for coal in the old days, and then it got converted to gas or oil. The house I lived in the mid-40s fell into that category. One of the things that I wanted to re-mention that Rich hit on is a beauty. And this is a really insidious problem. Because the darn many of the oil burners that Irwin investigated, that I've investigated, have much too rich a fuel-to-oil mixture. Too much oil, too little air. Smoky flame. Lots of black soot coming. There is no better insulation on planet Earth than that black soot. When it forms on the heat exchanger portion of your boiler, where you're trying to either heat the water, or in my case, I've got a warm air system, I'm trying to heat the air with a plenum. When that soot forms on that heat exchanger, it's a perfect insulator. Therefore, the heat of the flame is not being coupled into whatever is heating your house, air or water, and therefore, again, you're getting tremendous inefficiency. So look what happens here. Because you're putting too little air, getting a smoky flame, not getting the right amount of heat, making a lot of soot, the soot makes insulation. Insulation means you don't couple the heat into the house. It's only a double or a triple loss. You're making more carbon monoxide, more soot, more carbon into the air. It's non-green and expensive. Other than that, it's bad. You see where I'm going here. It's a runaway condition. I'm amazed that so many people will tolerate that. I'm willing to put a little bit of extra air where the flame is a little bit cooler. I get an extremely clean burning flame. I may be wasting a little bit of the efficiency because of the extra air that I'm putting in, but because of the cleanliness I get, and because I don't build up the insulation on the heat exchanger, and because I don't have to clean out the system so darn frequently, I'm way ahead of the game, in my opinion, with that approach. when in doubt, I say error on the side of excess air. The only place where you push that a little bit too far is maybe you'll blow out the flame on the windy day. But if you've got the right kind of a flame detector, the system will restart itself or turn itself off. So I have to press the reset button, which is a safety feature, when it's all working correctly. Bob, you may have some comments on all of this, because I believe you've got knowledge in this area. W2PNJ, K2LIW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe Bob got called away. Now, we're about to go back to real ham radio, folks. Hang in there. Anyone else want to make any comments before we leave this subject? And when Irwin comes back next week with a slightly better antenna and telling us about what this all got started because of Irwin, that's how I got started. I heard about what he was doing, what he did with his investigation, how many bad oil burners he found on Long Island when he had this contract from Brookhaven Laboratory to do this investigation. I call it an IRAD, Independent Research and Development is what he was doing. To find that many misset oil burners on Long Island, there's a lot more articles, a lot more knowledge to be spread, a lot more improvement to be had, and this whole area is thoroughly uninvestigated. There's a minor crime going on here from my point of view. Again, as you can say, I'm getting a little hot under the collar on this particular one. Anyone have any further comments before we go back to Real Ham Radio and pick up Joe's question? Give me your call with us right now.
Yeah, I got a question from Mel.
Go right ahead, Rich.
Oh, you too, TTT.
Rich and Mel and Rich and Gordon in that order. Rich first.
Okay. Now, when you switched over to gas, converted it, how old was the oil boiler that you had in the house?
What's the original coal furnace converted to oil? I know they did a lot of that. It's like kicking that gun system in the front there. That was a World War II firing system. I know that they used on ships or something. And they had a lot of them, I think, after World War II, and that's when they started taking out the front of the furnace and building those mechanisms. And they had back that enough of them in that business. This oil burner was a replacement unit. It would replace most, like, let's see, I came in, it was about, at that time, it was about, I'd say, 20 years old, the burner, because I believe it was put in the 50s. Had that problem with a lot of soot, cleaning the chimney every year and all, but I got a free, how could you beat it? I got a free brand new gas burner. And they also, at that time, what the situation is today, at that time, they did show me, and I compared it, I did a comparison, and with temperature, that's very close record to the temperature that year versus the year before. And for sure, I have to tell you, not only did I save money on heating the house, but my electric bill went down over.
Okay, Rich, you asked the question. Go ahead.
Well, my question is, the old boiler that you had...